Okay, I'm going to get started here. Yes, you have a question. Go ahead.
I was going to ask why are there so many more of this kind of stuff in cases, ADHD
and than there used to be?
Yeah, or is it or not? I'm always hearing about that.
Did you all hear that question? Why are there so many more cases? Like when I went to school, there was basically nobody had dyslexia or ADHD or ADD. I see some skeptical looks there. Think about that a little bit. Let's discuss that question. And as long as we don't go too far with the conspiracies, why, it'll be great. Great question. It's a good one. To start with, my aim for this class is I'm going to try to motor through some general things that I think are helpful when we're dealing with disabilities. They're general, and but I think they kind of do help in just so many situations. If it's a mild case, things like that, some of the things that I talk about can make a pretty big difference. However, every child is so different, and that's why I would like for you to have a chance to ask questions, and we have some people I know that have worked extensively, and so I think we can maybe actually give you some answers. First of all, just a quick little story. Where I live in Oregon, there's a river that is close to us, and this river is the Walla Walla River. The town is named after the river. The town's so nice, they named it twice, is what people say. The friendliest small town in America won that award recently. I have no idea why. I guess it was me. Maybe I was out. But this river is a really beautiful river. It runs up into the mountains, and in that river, there are steelhead. Now, steelhead are rainbow trout that go to the ocean to spend their adult life, and they come back to spawn. So a rainbow trout lays its eggs in this river, and in the spring, these eggs hatch, and they become little funny-looking little fish with an egg sac hanging down below, and then they quickly turn into tiny little fish, and they grow very quickly, and they become smolts. And then the spring runoff happens, where the snow melts in the mountain, and it washes, a big volume of water comes down, and it washes those smolts out the river. And the smolts go out swimming backwards, and they get to all the way down the Walla Walla River, and they come to the Columbia River. And then they have to turn around and take a left, and they motor down the river it's quite a ways. I forget the number. I knew this number at one point. And then they come to a dam. They go at least 100 miles, and then they come to a dam, and they have to go through that dam, and then they go down, and they crash at the bottom, and there's pike minnows there that are ready to eat them, and there's bull trout that are ready to eat them, and there's cormorants too. Cormorants come, and they're ready to eat these fish. But these fish, the ones that survive, get past the cormorants, they swim on, and they come to another dam, and the process is repeated. It's repeated 4 times for those particular fish, and eventually they get to the ocean. And then there's a whole world of predators there at the ocean ready to eat them. And if they survive, in 2 years, they'll arrive back at the mouth of the Columbia, and they've gone from the 6 to 9 inch smolt, to 24 28-inch steelhead. That's a big, powerful fish at that time. And part of the reason that's so big and powerful is because when they're in the ocean, they spend all their time swimming. A steelhead is basically a rainbow trout that's just one massive muscle. It's just a huge muscle. One of the things I've noticed about them is that their tail is always as tall as their whole body, and they use that tail constantly because they're always swimming. They're always fighting something or running from something. As a result, they're incredibly strong fish. And they swim back up that river, the mighty Columbia River. They go through the dam, and then they get to another dam. First they get to Bonneville Dam, and then they get to John Day Dam, and then they get to the I don't even remember, and you don't care. Those two more dams. And eventually they arrive back at our river, and they swim up that river, and then I catch them. Usually not, actually, only rarely. But there's something that I've thought about, and that is those fish are incredibly strong, largely because of two things. One is the food that they eat in the ocean and the struggle that they go through. Their brothers and sisters that they left there that didn't go with them, and this is an interesting fact for me, those the trout that stayed there and just became river trout, they're about 14 inches long. But the ones that went to the ocean became steelhead are 24 to 28 inches long. And they're stronger because of the struggle. Okay. As we talk about helping our students receive their full potential, I think we do have to be careful that we don't simply remove the need to struggle, because that is part of a productive life, to actually work hard. We don't want them to be just unsuccessful and never attain their potential. But I have seen sometimes where parents kind of gave up on their children and they just don't want them to be miserable. And I understand that too. But I think we should guard against that a little bit. Okay, so A here, a few things here. I actually forget what I put on your outline, but let's start with that one. As we think about a few principles of dealing with our students, is the child still able to be successful in school? Because that's very important. If they're never successful, they're just going to hate school, no matter how much you work on their attitude and tell them attitude is everything and put up good posters in the hallway and all that. They're just not going to enjoy it. Okay? If you're never successful, you will not enjoy it. And what is the B? What is the cost of changing the situation for the student? There's three things that I was thinking. One is the social cost of taking a student out of the classroom, making everybody see, kind of, that this person is different, just a little different. There's the emotional side of that, too, that you should think about, and the financial side. Sometimes putting somebody through Barton, for example, is very costly, and you need another teacher, you need a special ed teacher, things like that. I usually say, yeah, it's worth the cost. That's what I usually say. But you do have to think about it and understand this is some of the things you're going to deal with. Okay. And then a few teaching tips for teachers that I think work for a broad spectrum of people who are in the spectrum, sort of. Number one is keep your classroom organized. Structure is much more important for students with special needs, any kind of special needs. It's much more important than for the so-called normal children. I hate to use the word normal. I like the quote that normal is just the setting on the dryer, right? And it just barely applies. Do you guys consider are you normal? Pretty normal? No? Yeah. So, not a terribly helpful term, but we kind of know what it means. So, organization. One that was hard for me to learn, because it is not intuitive with me, is no surprises. I like surprises. They're great. They're wonderful. I like to surprise other people, maybe when they're really not expecting it, you know, in the dark or something. it's lovely. But I did learn that would really throw some of my students into a tailspin. I think of one in particular that I was just a little tired in history class. Let's go for a hike today. And this particular student just, I'm not going. Why not? No, I just don't want to go. And just stomped off to the bathroom. What do you do then? Well, she just went on a hike, left her there. And then I called and talked to her father later. But I think if I would have actually warned the student ahead of time, we wouldn't have had that scene. So surprises are not great usually. Remember that each child is an individual. I talked a tiny bit yesterday about going to prison. And this is just true about life in general, that if you start to label people and you see them as a syndrome or something like that, the worst case, I mentioned prison because that's the worst case. So let's say that you know about this person that he's a sex offender, right? All of a sudden that sucks, all that becomes his whole identity. And you can kind of never rise above that. That's kind of the worst case scenario. But do you understand what I'm saying? That's who he is. Well, you can kind of do that with your students if you're not careful. You look at them as a problem. And the thing that we need to understand with that is it's hard to have love and empathy, sympathy, for a problem. We just look at them as a problem. That's not helpful. We need to continue to look at them as a person and see what do they like, what do they enjoy, and make connections that way. And make sure that you're giving your students opportunities for success. And with some students, it is very difficult to give them an opportunity where they really shine. One of the things that I have seen, though, is that it seems like every student has an area in their life where they are actually maybe the best at something, at some activity. Let's see, I think this last year in particular scenario comes to mind. I decided this year, because I have some students who struggle just a tiny bit, that I'm going to teach all of them to juggle. I mean, everybody loves juggling, or you should. It's jolly good fun, and it teaches brain, hand, and eye coordination. There's something that happens actually in your brain when you learn to juggle. And so, okay, this is not a big deal, but we're going to practice this. I showed them the three-step method to learn to juggle three tennis balls, which is very simple. You learn to throw one hand to the other, left and right, left and right, left and right. Make sure you don't have to walk around to chase it. Then you do two, where you go one, two, and one, two, and one, two, and learn to do that until you can do that over and over. And then you just put in a third ball. It's really easy. You just go one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. Well, in 2 weeks, all of my students except two could juggle. And I was like, oh. And the two that couldn't, they had pretty good attitude. They kept doing it. And I gave it as part of their assignment that they had 2 minutes to practice that every morning. But there was one student that did just incredibly well. Really was funny. It was great to watch. It was a girl who was very insecure about herself. And she was not typically the first one to volunteer. She's very quiet. But she learned to juggle incredibly well. And it was also somebody that had some disabilities. I don't know why I get choked up thinking about it. It wasn't even that big a deal. But I was so tickled to see that she won our juggling competition that we had in a month or so. Yeah, just a little thing. I don't know why I get choked up thinking about it. But it actually, that tiny little thing that we did made a difference for her school year. And it really changed her attitude about school. Okay. Give them opportunity for success. Keep things simple. Make sure you don't try to give them a whole list of complicated instructions. And make sure that they know what you're expecting them to do. Because if reading is hard for them, and you give them a list of instructions, Maybe they can read two of them, but they don't understand two of them. And so there you've already really confused them. Make sure things are simple. And also, this is something that was difficult for me to learn. How many of you have done a classroom economy system? Okay, are still doing that like that? Okay, a little bit. So I started that, and 90% of my students thrived on it and thought it was just wonderful. But the students who struggled mightily with that. It was something extra that just added stress. And so we had it worked in as part of the behavioral thing too. And he would get upset because he fell behind on his rent for his desk, and he just, I don't even care, and he'd throw all his tickets away, and the other, yeah, it was just kind of a mess. His dad tried to tell me, if you could just somehow, just do something else with him, I think it'd be better. I hate to say, but I didn't listen. and looking back, I should have done something different with this one. Okay. And the last one I think on there, I don't know if I had this, is to keep your cool. It's fine to be animated and involved and passionate about school, but when they make a mistake, don't yell, "Charlie! Again!" Well, you shouldn't do that with the others, usually. But with some students, it works. But with them, it does not work. And I had to learn that. There was a student in particular I'm thinking of who would, if I was a little bit emphatic with her, she would start to laugh, kind of laugh, nervously. But I realized after getting to know her better that she's terrified. At that point, she's scared that I'm actually mad at her, and she would come back later and ask me, "Are you mad at me?" No, I was just being exuberant. So I had to really learn that actually does not work. I got to curb my exuberance on some things like that. How many of you are here as parents? Okay. Good. So I have a couple things here. There's some crossover here for parents. Number one, quickly, manage your expectations, even if your child has a specific diagnosis. He's still an individual, and you can't expect him to fit in a box. He's you know that, right? Celebrate small accomplishments. Make sure that... make sure that when he has small victories, that they're noted, okay? The more you learn about his challenges, the more you'll identify the small successes there. And I had to think about one of those. I talked about Ricardo yesterday. And I remember that one week I had just a completely smooth week. There was no problems at all. And he behaved. It was wonderful. And I went home, and I just happened to mention it to Tim, my Uncle Tim. And he said, "You need to go over and tell his dad. Go talk to his dad right now. Get on your bike and go tell him, hey, he was really good today, this week, this whole week." So I did. Oh, yeah, sure. It's a great idea. So I went over, met his dad, and his dad later told somebody, "Oh, he saw Mr. John coming." And he's like, "Oh, no. What this time?" And he was just, he was shocked that I told him something good. Well, that does reflect on me, I know that, but you can use my bad examples to do better. Partner with your child's teacher. Your teacher wants the best for this child. They don't want to be in conflict with you. The other one is stick to a daily routine. Sticking to a predictable routine is really, really critical. And I would say part of that is diet. You know, think about steelhead. Steelhead do so well in the ocean because there's a tremendous amount of krill. And they eat krill, and they grow huge and large and fat and rosy-cheeked. Okay? That's what you want for your children. Well, not all of that, but you want them to eat healthy. Okay? And a daily routine is very important for stability. Chaos in a child's life is just creates chaos for them emotionally and mentally, and especially if they have any kind of disability, it's just much harder. And then, of course, take care of yourself. If you're worn down, what happens? And this is true for parents and teachers. If you're worn down, you tend to be just a bit more of a snapping turtle, right? And that is also not good for your child. Okay. Any questions on any of that? Just rattled through there. You all just sleeping, or you're all agreeing, or? I know, it's, what time is it? It's 2:30. Huh. That's all right. Okay, and then just a couple more things for both, for children. One is that penalties still apply. We talked about that yesterday a little bit. There's consequences for bad behavior. It has to be that way. And there was somebody reminded me of something too. When we're looking at trying to decide whether it's disobedience or disability, it's best if you just treat it as disobedience at first, because that's the natural bent of children, right? When it's repeated and it's, you see some of these other traits coming through, understand that that's when you start to maybe change your methods. Okay, but first off, children are just have the spirit of Adam, and we understand that. Also, show compassion. Make sure compassion is something that is really, really vital. It's basically showing love, mercy, grace, all the things that we need. And if a student is just frustrated, and they feel like you're just critical of them, that's a losing situation. But if they sense your teacher is trying to help, you can overcome a lot of things that way. Something I hope you can understand here is that sometimes we may actually spend too much time with an unwilling student. Okay? Somebody that just really doesn't want to learn. And you can just pour your energies into that child because you want them to succeed and you want them to read well and things like that. And you neglect your 12 other students. We have to be careful not to do that. Now, if you're a special ed teacher and you can do one-on-one, it's a little bit different. But make sure that we're not just pouring all our energy into a child who's unwilling. Okay? I hope you understand that. And close to the last point here is that we need to strive to make school make sense for our students. I hope that makes sense to you when you hear what I'm saying. But let's see, in the textbook you'll read a paragraph maybe and you understand most of it. Maybe you understand 80% of it, but there's a few sentences that don't make sense, right? Well, you kind of got the idea of that, and you read it again, and, oh yeah, that makes sense. Or four or five times, and it all makes sense. But what about a student who, he reads that paragraph, and there's four words that make sense? And that's the way school is for them. How much of school cannot make sense before school doesn't make sense at all? Does that make sense? Like, what percentage Well, you want them to understand, oh, you know, 90%, 100% is great. But nobody ever understands 100%. But if they're only understanding 20%, are they wasting their time? We need to do something different. And the other thing, this is my full point here actually, is that how much of school cannot make sense before life itself doesn't make sense to them? Okay. And I gave you a few questions here, but do y'all have any questions, first of all? Oh, I put them on your handout, and I don't have one, but that's all right. What's that first question I gave you, Gerald?
What if the parents don't believe there is a disability or refuse to believe it happens?
Okay. So I carefully did not even think about that question so that you all would answer that for me. I did think about it a little bit. But what do you do if the parents don't believe that there is a disability, that the child has a disability?
Still not your child. I had someone tell me once, parents are always right.
Parents are always right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that the way we answer all these questions?
Almost.
There's a trend there. Okay. What a great way to kill a discussion.
Sorry.
No, I'm not blaming you. It was me.
Sometimes if there are like little, depending what it's for, like written things that they can do that kind of give you an idea that you mm-hmm. can do at school, and then be like, this is what we see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of weak down a little bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can't force them to believe, but they don't believe, but you can at least put a little bit of evidence in front of them.
Mm-hmm. You do need to have evidence. It's not just, I just don't really like the way he, you know, whatever. Pick something.
If it's a disability in reading, I have a last year, I have a child that struggled, and parents feel with it, so it was, mm-hmm. at that point, we didn't know. So that made it easier, but if the parents hear the child read at home, or mm-hmm. try to read, but we're reading at school, and they can, because they know the child, they makes sense to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can see the child is trying or mm-hmm. not trying, whatever.
Yeah, that's a good point. Another scenario, when you're talking about reading, so let's say you're talking about second graders, perhaps, first or second graders. I've seen a scenario where, you know, the parents just kind of got used to this fellow just kind of stumbles and stops and hesitates, and that's just the way he is. And then they went to school, and they heard the whole class, and they heard the other second graders read through it, and then came to him. And they really opened their eyes that, this is actually not normal. So I like that idea. Be sneaky. Don't use a label. Yeah. I like where you're going with that. I do think that what Justice says here is kind of the overarching thing that we think about. And yet, I want to say, too, that as a teacher, you're an advocate. Advocate, is that the right word? For the child. Advocate means lawyer, and that has a connotation that I'm not sure is perfect. But you are seeing something at school that the parents may not actually see. And so you do have a voice, and do not be afraid of using that voice. I am very glad when teachers come and talk to me about my children. Not really, but but I do value what they see because they're with them in the classroom. And it's been helpful to see, to hear their wisdom. Mm-hmm. So anybody here have dyslexia? We have one. We should clap for you. I don't want to make you feel awkward. You know, probably more than her, honestly. Because there's so many so many people actually do kind of get through and don't realize that they have it. And it's like there's severe to moderate to almost nothing to that whole thing. But I've wondered already if I have it because I'll see things backwards. In fact, I wrote some things about dyslexia, and I spelled dyslexia wrong. I realized after, hey, what's wrong with that? So, I don't know. But, yes?
You also spelled situation wrong on my handout.
Justice. Thank you so much. Thank you. Reminds me of a funny story, but okay. I had thought about trying to go over just a few things for dyslexia and ADHD, ADD, ADHD. But I would actually, I'd really like for you to be able to ask questions. So do you have questions right now about a situation you're facing in school or anybody have any questions, or maybe your child? Yes, sir.
I want to throw out there, the parent mentioned diet earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And for two of our children, that can be the difference between a disability and not.
Absolutely. Are there specific things that you could name that trigger it?
Yes. Our son, sugar.
Sugar.
Food mm-hmm. coloring, which is not unusual. And we have two other, a daughter especially, anything dairy.
Mm-hmm.
Go from a sweet child to
mm-hmm. Yes, and how old were they when you noticed this?
2
Okay.
The oldest one was 2.5, 3, mm-hmm. the youngest one, 1 year old.
Mm-hmm.
As parents are more aware.
Okay. I think I had a student who was in her teens when parents became aware of her pretty serious negative reaction to sugar. And so they cut sugar from her diet. And I'm pretty sure I was teaching her while they did this, actually. And it made a dramatic difference in her disposition. So sugar is basically a bad chemical. I don't love it, or some people love it. At least you had a question.
I had a student one time in Georgia where they like to
So a boiled egg. You fry an egg for him there.
Scramble it, whatever. I don't know.
It's a little hard to imagine him coming in the door and you say, here, have an egg. But, I mean, it would work.
Like at recess.
Oh, recess, okay.
Somewhere where food, you know, it wasn't so often.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I am a firm believer in breakfast. I eat breakfast every day, every morning. If I get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, I still eat breakfast. It was a trial for my wife when we got married, and well, I don't think getting married was that much of a trial, but when we got, she realized that I'm going to get up at 4 o'clock to go to work some days, and she's supposed to get up too and like cook breakfast. This is stressful. But she's a wonderful lady, and she's just superwoman. Okay, any other questions there? I had, you had asked a question at the beginning, and I just remembered though. And you want to state your question again for us? If you forgot what it was, it's fine.
My question was, why is there so many more labeled disabilities now than there was 50 years ago? Are we just more aware of it? Or are it just parents trying to excuse the rod? Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, why?
Okay. That's a really good question. Yes.
I taught about 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So diagnosing them has ramped up incredibly. And it seems like it's mostly older people that say, yeah, it's just an excuse. That most people don't actually say that. But there's a tendency that, you know, what's happening? What's the deal here? Is this people excuse? Is this just a huge extension of gentle parenting? I don't think it is. I'm gonna say, I think there's been a great increase in accurate diagnosing these things. People did not know. A lot of these terms are actually not that old. ODD is only a few years old, which ODD is the one that I'm the most skeptical of. But there may be some truth to it. But the others, I would have gone to school with people that had it, had some evidence or symptoms of it. Any other comments on that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is, it contributes hugely to that. Especially if, we talked about that just a little bit, if you weren't in here yesterday. That is basically, so a child that suffers from autism, has autism, or ADD or ADHD, well, it's mostly autism, I guess. But they really have an overstimulation. Their senses are just overstimulated. They see all the fan blades all the time, and they can't zone things out. So they can't really focus on something. It's just all this stuff is crowding in. Where if you just stop for a second, or a few, 20 seconds, and just try to hear everything that's happening. I noticed that the person clicking their pen stopped, which is... That actually doesn't bother me. But it might bother me, so that's a sign that I don't have autism, because if I did, that would bother me, likely. So, Judy is looking concerned, but... I mean... Yeah, okay. Well, there's other things that do really bother me, like chewing loudly. Yes, Joe. Correct.
In other words, saying I have the measles, there's nothing wrong with that. We want to go from having measles to being, you know, to the cure.
Mm-hmm.
I think when I was to have measles, therefore, the rest of my life is ruined with measles.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what they're in the problem lines or not?
Yeah. That's exactly right. Hopefully the rest of your life isn't ruined with measles either. But that is the issue, where a parent says, oh, you know, my child has Asperger's disease. Let's just give him a pass on everything. And, I mean, you've given up on your child at that point, I think. So I strongly disagree with that mentality. Okay. One of the things I want to mention too, so how many of you are going to be working or have been working with children with dyslexia? Okay. All of you know about the Barton program and Phonics Foundations. I wish we had that 20 years ago. I'm excited with the developments of that learning. So, but just basically, multisensory learning, where you're not just writing things down, but you're handling things, you're listening to things, magnets and sticking magnets together to form letters, or forming them with sand, kinetic sand, there's things like that. Also, I have seen a real improvement when they participate to the very best of their ability, and you have to push them at this, in non-reading activities like music. Now, I know we read in music, but you can also listen to it and learn a song that way and then sing it back. And I think that's one of the handicaps of people with severe dyslexia, don't learn to read, and they don't learn to really learn the songs. I find that to be a huge disadvantage in life, not to know songs. So make sure, if they struggle to keep up reading a song, that they learn songs. Okay, I think that is a really, really big thing. And also, I have really seen them excel sometimes at art. And sometimes I've seen them, it's really difficult for them to draw. I mean, they can't, yeah. You really have to be careful and gentle when you ask them what their scene is depicting. So, also, let's see. One of the things, too, that is true, and I forget, let me see, was this for dyslexia? Well, this was for ADD. But it's for both of them. Make sure that they are building relationships. Okay? Don't get so focused on their academics that you forget that school is hugely, hugely social. Make sure that social life figures into that they have success socially. Does that make sense? They have friends. They have people that are supporting them. And this is where, when you have older students who are still working through some of these things, maybe you have a scenario that works pretty well is if you have a seventh grader and you have a 10th grader who's their mentor buddy. He's going to help them. He's just going to kind of be their buddy. Okay, that can really help. And you can kind of help to orchestrate some of those relationships. And I think especially maybe, it's not as much with dyslexia, because I've seen them actually be very, very successful socially. But with ADD or ADHD or FAS, they can really sacrifice a friendship very quickly in three tantrums. And children, young students, they don't like to be shouted at and called names or treated unkindly. And that is unfortunately one of the outworkings of some of these things, of FAS, for example, and ADD and ADHD. So if you can help them work through those behaviors. Also, make sure that you, when you give commands or directions to them, be practical and make eye contact with them. Maybe guide them with your hand a little bit. I want you to go over here. And also, if they're being distracted, often if you just walk over and you stand beside them, or tap your finger on their desk just a little bit, or just little things can recenter their focus just a little bit. They're probably all stuff that you do and you know. Okay. Any other questions?
Just something to add to what you just got done saying about being distracted or not getting your thinking into focus. My first grader last year, or the struggling one, he was being too pressured. He felt too much pressure,
sure.
So it was too overwhelming for him to live. When we backed off and decided not to pressure him as much, it's okay if he has to be frustrated. It was a lot more work for me because I had to tell him every little thing to do. But he could taste it.
Okay. So back off on the pressure sometimes. So along with that, is it all right to drop a subject sometimes? You all agree? Mostly agree? Kind of? Maybe disagree. Don't drop a subject. Okay. So pretty strong consensus there. So I really dislike dropping a subject because I've seen so often that it's their time is just kind of like gas, right? A gas just expands to fill whatever is container it's in. And it seems like so often they're not actually less busy. But it does work at times, and I definitely do it. And I will do it this year again. So it does work. I just don't like it that much. So okay. Well, thank you for your questions and contributions, and you're dismissed.